chapters 13 and 14. This will be the next to last class, the next to last pair of chapters that we'll do. We are nearly done with our book, and they are nearly done with their adventure. So let's recap briefly to find out where we are, to make sure that we are we're on the same page here. As they have continued to travel from Koryakin's Island and the Duffelpuds, they spent that time with the magician getting to know him. The Duffelpuds have been made visible, and they are basically those big one giant footed dwarves, and now they're happy again. They have a celebration as Caspian and crew have sort of reloaded, resupplied, and then set off. So they do believe that they are narrowing down on their the number of lords that they have been out to see, and they happen to find the next one deep in the darkness. As they are sailing, they sail into an area of just dismal blackness where there is no light whatsoever. After debating whether or not they should go around it, they decide to engage in the adventure to go through it. And in the pitch black darkness where they can't see a thing, they can't see where they've gone or where they're going, they hear a cry. They bring someone on board, a crazed old man, a shell of a man. But this man turned out to be who?
One of the lords,
Lord Roop. He has been stuck in this black darkness, and what does he tell them happens on this enchanted island?
Well, this is the land of dreams.
Dreams come true.
Yeah, and it's not like nightmares.
So these dreams that come true, initially, the crew is very interested. And he has to remind them, not daydreams, not, oh, I wish. I mean the uncontrolled, uncontrollable bizarreness of an actual dream. Whether it's a nightmare or even a good dream, the rules of life and the physics of the world, they're all out the window, and anything can happen, and terrible things can happen, and we're completely out of control, and this has been an absolute and abject curse. He has been on the brink of insanity. And them finding him is the closest thing he's come to salvation in a long time. And just as they realize how dangerous this is, and they start to turn around, they realize that they're stuck. They've gone further than they came in time-wise, but they feel like they're nowhere near to getting out. Maybe they're going in circles. Maybe it's expanding. Maybe it's trapping them. They don't know, but there doesn't seem to be any hope left. And so what happens?
Lucy cries out to
Aslan and for his mercy. And that mercy comes this time in the form of an albatross. The albatross, the seabird, the lucky bird of sailors, like a light illuminating the darkness with the voice and the breath and the peace of Aslan accompanying it, give the sailors, it sort of steadies their nerves and then guides them right out of the darkness. After they have left the darkness, they turn around and what do they notice?
They don't see anything.
It's all gone.
It's not there.
It's all gone. Whether the curse has been destroyed, yes, or it has just been fulfilled for this time or whatever it is, but that darkness has now disappeared. The Lord Roop is desperately grateful and thankful. He reveals that there are just three more lords who he knows have gone further than him, but knows nothing of them. And so from this calamity, which exhausts them, that was sort of the interesting thing about it. When we look at their discussions on it, this whole thing might have lasted a half an hour, maybe less. but they come through it as though it were one of the deadliest dangers they had faced in any of this. They're worn out, they're exhausted, a bunch of them fall asleep. They just feel kind of lucky to be alive. So the albatross disappears, they need him no longer, and off they continue to sail, which brings us to chapter 13. So.
I was interested that Lord Rupe asked a boon of Caspian. That was from the Rupe I turned around.
Right, right. A very feudal thing to ask of one's lord or king. as they continue to sail, what do you notice about the changes in the environment?
In the east, there's a new constellation up here in the east, which was interesting.
They're seeing things they've never seen before, that maybe no one has ever seen. Mm-hmm. They see these new constellations. What's the water like?
It's gentle.
It's very calm. Even the breeze is calm, and yet the boat still seems to move with some speed. The nights are warm. It seems to be gentle and beautiful. It seems to be different than just the open ocean. Hard to maybe pin down, but what's something they notice about the stars and the sun?
They're bigger and brighter.
Yeah. Like they're getting closer somehow.
And there was a glorious sunset.
Yeah. So they come across a land, land that even from a distance feels different and feels beautiful and feels almost enchanting. Lucy calls it a dim purple kind of smell, which she's exactly sure what that means, but Caspian seems to get it. They drop anchor, several of them row ashore.
They were looking for a bay, but they didn't get that. Yeah.
Nope, didn't get a bay, but this wasn't dangerous. This wasn't like, you know, rocky shoals. No. This just, they had to leave the ship. So, when they get on land, what do they find?
A ruin. Was the way someone described it. Mm-hmm. Turned out to be an unroofed
patio table.
Yeah. I think maybe with pillars at the corner or something that might have looked like a ruin, but it just doesn't have a roof.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what do they find there in this pavilion on what otherwise looks like a deserted island? A beautiful island, but it looks like no one's ever stepped foot there. What do they find in this pavilion?
A large table dressed with a red cloth.
With chairs.
Carved and pushing chairs. And on the table was a sumptuous banquet.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And there were three beings.
All right. Now,
covered in hair.
You would think, after all this time, even when they've eaten well, none of them have ever seen a feast like this. Mm-hmm. They even make a note that, you know, even in the most lavish of feasts in the time of High King Peter, they had never seen a table set like this before. So these are sailors who have been, you know, on a boat for quite some time. Why don't they just jump all over this food?
After their experience with magicians and so forth, I have a feeling they might be a little leery of what it...
Sure. I mean, there was even a pool that turned people into solid gold. You kind of have to be careful about what you touch in these parts. And what gives them even more pause when they look around the table?
Well, those three beings covered in hair
okay.
are sleeping or something.
Yeah. All right, so they find...
They think they're sleeping.
They find the three sleepers of the title of the chapter.
Dead first. They think they're dead. These
three dead bodies, except they're not. They're warm, they're breathing, their hearts beat.
But shaking did not wake them.
So they're in an enchanted sleep.
They're in some kind of enchanted sleep. So, matter of fact, they try to wake all three of them, and what did we get out of them?
Just the notice of the breathing.
They actually say a little something. Like, you know, one's Each one says something a little bit less, to the point where the last one is like, mustard, please, and just kind of collapses again into an even deeper sleep.
That's right. They did say some words.
Well, they didn't look like anyone or anything because it's as though their hair, the hair of their heads and the hair of their beards had just kind of grown like vines everywhere. Mm-hmm. So they just looked like shaggy things of hair.
Mm-hmm. They talked about going eastward. Some of the words they were saying, mm-hmm. heading eastward. Mm-hmm.
Words out for Narnia, said one of them. Mm-hmm. So one wants to go east, one wants to go home, and one wants to eat.
Yeah.
And yet all three are in this incredibly deep, enchanted sleep. So deep that their hair has grown wild. But they are able to still identify who these sleepers are by what they're wearing.
By the rings, it said.
Okay?
Yeah.
So who are they?
Are they Lord Rivillian, Lord, how do you say it?
Argos
and
Mavrimorn. So here are the final three lords. Okay? If the quest was to find these seven lords, here are the final three in this bizarre enchanted sleep at this amazing table. And so between the odd things that they've seen already and the fact that there are these three lords they cannot rouse from an enchanted sleep, they all decide we are not going to have any of this food.
Right. They think it may have the food in it caused.
Well, yeah. I mean, what if you ate something or you touched something even and it puts you to sleep forever. So that's not a great idea. Mm-hmm. So why not just turn around and go? You found your three lords. You can't wake them up. This food is mysterious and potentially very dangerous. Quest over, row for home. Why don't they do that?
Well, they don't because they're Vika cheap.
Okay.
He mentions and reaffirms the fact that about being on an adventure, right?
That's right.
It's an adventure.
He is on an adventure, and frankly, he has personal reasons to want to continue no matter what.
Yeah.
But, you know, time and again, sometimes for good and sometimes for bad. Reepicheep has said, this is an adventure and we ought to take it. I will say the one time that occurs to me that his adventurous nature got them in trouble was the last chapter of The Dark Island, where he was the one who said, you know, why should we turn tail?
Yeah.
But as scary as that was, and as foolhardy as it might have been to have gone in, what was accomplished through it? They found one of the lords, and they would not have found him otherwise. Number one, it was part of the fulfillment of their quest and Caspian's oath. But number two, it saved Lord Roop. He would have been condemned to however much longer in that nightmare world had they not moved through bravely. So, Reepicheep says, I'm going to stay and figure out what's going on. So Caspian sends kind of the other crewmates to go back. Who is willing to stay?
All of them.
Lucy,
Edmund,
Caspian stays.
And Eustace.
And Eustace. So remember how he has been changing ever since his time as a dragon, ever since he's been baptized by Aslan. He is becoming more dependable, less whiny. He's even shown courage. And here's another step. He doesn't know what to make of any of this. He hasn't even read the adventure books where stuff like this might turn out well. He just knows that this is desperately dangerous, but he is willing to stay. So there are the five people who are staying. Everyone else leaves. And you're just sitting and watching this truly bizarre scene. So what do they do?
Well, I haven't quite a time deciding where they're going to sit at the table.
Yeah,
first table.
Right. You know, you don't want to sit too close to those weird hairy things because it's unnerving. But if you sit too far away, then you can't see what's happening in case something were to happen. And so they wind up kind of sitting sort of in the middle, but, you know, close enough to keep an eye on the three sleeping lords. But as they wait, and day turns to night, and the strange constellations, and it's a little colder, and it just seems like nothing is going to happen until something does. What finally happens?
A door opens in the hillside.
And a figure carrying a light.
Okay, what kind of figure?
Turns to be a girl.
Dressed in blue.
Very beautiful with blonde hair. Mm-hmm. I think Caspian likes her.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I'd say so by the end.
Well, I mean, even, you know, all of them have this sense of they've not seen beauty until they have seen this, this woman. This strange woman who has come out of a hillside, who seems to be almost glowing with light. She's carrying a candle, and the flame is perfectly upright as though there were no breeze whatsoever. And so when she comes to the table, what kind of effect does that have on the people there?
Well, men all stood up.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just kind of instinctually knew they were in the presence of someone great, someone important, someone special, and, you know, just the need to be respectful.
Right.
You know, it just sort of is. And so,
and just about at the same time, it was sort of thrown in that Lucy noticed the knife lying on the table.
Knife of stone, sharp as steel, cruel and ancient looking thing. That's right. Mm-hmm. So, who breaks the silence?
Well, she asked why they didn't eat.
That's right. Travelers who have come far to Aslan's table, why do you not even drink? So, what is the explanation of all of this?
I feared food was magic. That was what caused the three. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, and what is her explanation? So all starts to come clear through this interaction.
They came on a strangely bedraggled ship, and one decided to sit down.
Well, she explains it's not the food that has put them to sleep.
Right.
They've never even tasted the food.
No.
So the three of them arrived.
Okay. Something about ending their days in pain.
They started to argue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One wanted to go further. One wanted to stop and stay. One wanted to go home. Mm-hmm. And they begin, these three lords, arguing about what they ought to do next. Mm-hmm. And what happened?
The one picks up that knife.
Someone
grabs the knife.
The stone knife.
Yes.
And that is something that they should not touch.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's a deep sleep.
Boom. That's the enchantment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Their arguments, out of fatigue, out of frustration, out of desperation, out of annoyance, whatever it was, and it escalated, and then someone, in time of escalation, A, wanted to commit harm, if not outright murder. Mm-hmm. You know, you're having a terrible argument with somebody, and somebody grabs a knife. You've upped the ante, you know? But they have now grabbed something that they should not have touched. And the magic upon it was so powerful that all three instantly fell into this deep and enchanted sleep. Mm-hmm. Why should they have not touched this stone knife?
Well, it's the knife that the White Witch used.
It is the stone knife. So way back in the time of the first adventure in Narnia, when the children were young, and Aslan gave his life for Edmund's on the stone table. Mm-hmm. That was the knife that pierced him and killed him. Yes. It's like grabbing the true cross. It's like grabbing the spear of Longinus. It's like something that had actually pierced the flesh of Christ. Imagine the sacred nature of that, and then being used in an argument. And it's just not right. You know, this is like the Ark of the Covenant. You know, people touched it when they shouldn't have, and they died. So someone goes to grab the stone knife, and they grab it in anger, and there is this powerful enchantment. Now, it doesn't kill them, doesn't obliterate them, but they are in an enchanted sleep, and they cannot be woken through natural means. So she says that this food is perfectly good to eat, and it's Edmund now who finally speaks, and he says, well, you know, I want to believe you, because I look at you and I think you're telling me the truth, that it's not the food that put these guys to sleep and the food is okay to eat. But how can I really know? After all we've seen, how can I really know that that's true? And what is her response?
It says you either believe or you don't.
You either believe or you don't.
Yeah.
And that's pretty true.
Kind of
ultimately, it's pretty true.
Yeah.
Now, so who takes the step of bravery and boldness?
Reepicheep.
Once
Reepicheep. Drink to the lady.
Reepicheep will try the food. He wishes to toast.
Wants to toast
the lady, and suddenly everyone's like, "We might as well." And so they dig in. And so as they're eating, the question comes up, why is it called Aslan's table? So what's the explanation for that?
He set the table there. He's the one that put the table there.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. For those who come so far. Mm-hmm.
Some call this island the world's end. For though you can sail further, this is the beginning of the end. It is eaten and it is renewed every day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what should this make you think of?
Eucharist?
There's definitely a Eucharistic element of this. I think this is a vision of heaven.
God's mercy.
This is a vision of the heavenly banquet.
Mm-hmm.
The
yes.
wedding supper of the Lamb.
Yeah.
You know, we are told that heaven is like a feast and banquet, of which the Eucharist is kind of a glimpse. But here the table is set for the wedding supper of the Lamb, and the union of Christ with his church is something to be celebrated with the greatest of feasts. And so for these blessings and these mercies to be renewed every day, isn't that like the never-ending feast of Christ and his church in full and in glorious union? So I think they're kind of seeing the outskirts of heaven here. It's the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of the end of the mortal world. And here is this food of a feast that you cannot begin to imagine how amazing it is, and yet it is renewed every day. So the girl is asked about, is it possible to break the enchantment of the sleepers? You know, kind of like Sleeping Beauty, you know, there would be a sleeping princess and the prince would come and kiss her and then everything would be restored.
Interesting. Caspian is the one saying that.
Well, and he said, you know, my friends will tell stories of you know, this happening from their world. And so she gives an answer that it's not going to be that easy, but there is a way to break the enchantment. But who will teach them how to do this?
Her father.
And here he comes. So, we go on to the next page, which is the next chapter, the beginning of the end of the world. And here comes...
What's his
name?
Romandu.
It sounds like something familiar, but I couldn't remember what it was.
It does,
So this is the door on the hillside. And who is coming out?
He came out. The old man.
Okay, tall and straight as a girl, but not so slender. He's not carrying a candle.
Silver beard.
But where's the light coming from?
From him.
From him. Light comes out from him.
Interesting.
Again, he looks so significant, so important, almost so holy. They all stand again and they're quiet.
Yeah.
So what happens when the old man reaches the table?
It lights up, like it just becomes alive, right? Kind of like the food, everything.
And he and his daughter
raise their hands and sing.
Begin to sing.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of song?
A cold kind of song.
Cold?
I'm not sure I know what cold songs are, but
an early morning kind of song.
Mm-hmm.
The east began to turn red. The sun came up out of the sea. Like it's just the whole environment.
It's a beautiful song, but it seems kind of chilly, kind of cool.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like the song of the dawn. They're almost singing the dawn into coming, and the light and the sun, and it rises.
Yes.
And if you think about it, that kind of twilight dawn moment is rather cool.
Okay.
And they are singing the morning into existence almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so the light comes, the sun rises, and what do they know about the sun now that they can see it rising?
It's bigger.
It is bigger. It's not a trick, it's not an illusion. It's bigger, it's closer, and they can tell, and they just know. And now they absolutely know that some way, somehow, they are near the edge and end of the world. So something begins to also make noise as though it were in response to the song. What happens?
This bird. Flying to the old man.
Bird. And the birds are actually echoing the song.
Mm-hmm.
They're singing the same song, but in kind of a wild, natural, animal, bird version of it. And they join in. And then it's as though the whole area is covered with these birds.
Even people.
So what happens?
This one bird flies to the old man.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like there's something like a fruit, some kind of fruit in his mouth.
Mm-hmm. Like a fruit or like a live coal.
And it laid it in the
It's too bright to look at.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does that remind you of anything?
Yes, in the Bible. The one who got the toe on his tongue.
That's right. We just had this a few weeks ago. This is Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah has a vision of the Lord's glory filling the temple, and he says, I'm a man of unclean lips. I've seen the Lord, and I'm going to die. And God says no, and sends one of the seraphim with a live coal and touches it to his lips and says, your sins have been forgiven. So I'm kind of getting all of this in here.
Wow.
Shivers.
So the birds have now eaten or carried away everything, and the table is now clean, and it is empty. The lords are asleep, and the old man turns and begins to speak. So, what does he say?
Caspian asks him to tell how to undo the enchantment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And
he says,
tell them.
You must sail to the world's end, or as near as you can, come to it.
And one must stay behind.
And one has to stay behind.
But as you return, the sleepers will awaken.
Yes.
So you must go into the utter east and never return. And what does Rinpoche's response?
That is
he
my
wants
heart's
to go.
Desire.
So,
desire.
This is what he's been waiting for.
This
has been from the lullaby. This has been his quest. This has been everything that he has wanted, is to sail into the utter east and never return again.
Bless his little heart.
And so they say, well, can you tell us what happens next when we go to sail that way? What does he say? It's so interesting.
He saw the long but from a great height.
Yes, which was interesting.
Right. And there's Eustace. Oh, you were flying?
Yeah.
Good old Eustace.
Yeah, not quite, Ramandu says.
Yeah.
He was a star.
He was a star.
Yeah, that was
now,
interesting.
How does Edmund describe him?
He's a retired star.
So basically, he is not an active star within the heavens, but it's not that he's no longer a star at all. So the concept of retirement, I think, sort of works.
Yeah.
He calls himself a star at rest. When I set for the last time, decrepit and old beyond all you can reckon, I was carried to this island. I am not so old as I was then. Every morning a bird brings me a fireberry from the valleys of the sun, and each fireberry takes away a little of my age. And when I have become as young as the young child was born yesterday, I shall take my rising again, for at the earth's eastern rim, and once more tread the great dance.
Okay.
So, he is being renewed day by day. And there is this sort of cyclical nature of the life and the work of a star. He was bright and illumined from the sky and above the sky for however long, and now he rests and is renewed, and then will return at some point again. And it's just kind of this beautiful little description. Now, Eustace asks a question, or makes a statement, that only Eustace could make. And it's not out of malice. He would have been a snotty know-it-all if he had said this same thing earlier in the book. But I don't think he's doing it that way.
I think he's
legitimately interested.
Physical truth.
Yeah, he is legitimately interested. He used to say facts just and he would learn facts just to show people that he was smart. Now he knows something. And I think he's just legitimately interested in the differences. Mm-hmm. So what does he say?
Yes, he says that the star is a huge ball of flame.
In our world, a star is a huge ball of flaming gas. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of the most important phrases that happens in the entire book, and it's almost, you won't even catch it unless you really let it think. Even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of. I want you to think about that and how profound that statement truly is.
It's about us, too.
Well, that's right.
We're not just the body.
That is a statement that is near and dear to the heart of C.S. Lewis's philosophy of reality, of the world, of the cosmos, of humanity, of everything. This is a man who has the soul of a poet. What something is, it's not less than what it's made of, but it's more. So think about this as about a star. In our world, a star is a ball of flaming gas. Eustace is right. What else is a star?
Light.
It's light. What else?
It's direction.
Mm-hmm. I would say it's also inspiration. Mm-hmm. It's also happiness. It's also, we use it to describe celebrities or important people. When we see stars, we write music about them. We make wishes on them. We know which way is north. These things, that's a part of what it means to be a star. It's not just what it's composed of. It's not less than that. You know, if you ever, you know, find the thing about it, you know, human body is mostly water and it's $12 worth of chemicals or whatever it is, that's true. But is that all you are? Or are you more? Take any definition of something that comprises you, something you can say, this is who I am. You're not less than that, but you're still more. Are you a woman? Yes. Mm-hmm. But you're more. Mm-hmm. You know? And are you an American? Yes. But you're more. Whatever element we want to choose from, and that could be about all sorts of things, not just our humanity and not just about the stars, but to not be so crass and crude and reductionistic in our thinking, that we begin to realize that things are more than what they're made of. They are also what they mean. They're also what they're valued as. They're also what they can do. They're also what they make us feel like. There are all these things, and they are more. And that is really one of the things at the heart of C.S. Lewis's own philosophy. A thing is not just a thing. It's more. So this follows up with, you've actually met a star. Who was a star?
Craig.
The magician.
The magician
was also a star. Was he retired?
Well, not exactly.
More like being punished. So this whole custody, the custodian, the caretaker of the Duffelpuds, which clearly he was, you know, responsible for them, and he wanted to, you know, care for them. That was kind of a punishment. Now, remember that Aslan was there with Koryakin. Did they seem to be at odds at all? No, not in the least. And so they want to know, well, what did he do?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the response to that?
He says it's not for you, son of Adam.
No, what faults a star can commit? We're almost looking at, like, different spheres of being.
Yes.
You know, that's like, what are the sins of angels?
Whole different world.
You know, that's not really for us to get into.
No.
So he basically kind of brushes that aside, that it's not really for them to know. Maybe they wouldn't even understand. Mm-hmm. But it does not seem to be an odious or a terrible thing to Koryakin. Willingly accepts this, and he seems content enough, and it's just one of those things.
Yeah.
But in sweeping it aside, he says, will you continue to sail east and leave someone, or is your plan to go back home? So who responds? Once again,
Rinpoche.
It's plainly part of our quest to try to rescue these lords. And Caspian now chips in. You know, even if we didn't have to go to the end to save these lords, like let's say we could just throw them up back on the ship and they'd be okay, how could we get to the beginning of the end and not want to go all the way?
Mm-hmm.
But we have a dilemma. What's the dilemma?
The crew really hasn't been in on all this, and he thinks they need to be considered.
That's right. What did the crew sign on for? Exploration and adventure, yes. But what was the explicit goal? Caspian makes an oath at his coronation. And what is the explicit goal?
To find
the seven lords.
Yeah.
So, if they had found the seven lords two or three islands ago, would they have gone this far? Probably not. If they had found all seven lords, say with the Duffelpuds, or the rest of them, maybe they turn around from there. But they found them, and they're now given a choice. You can assume that your quest is fulfilled because you have fulfilled your oath in finding the lords, or you can realize that you are on the threshold now of the final adventure, and you may continue forward, continue east to the other end. And in doing so, you will actually save the lives of the lords that you have pledged to find. So, there seems to be a pretty clear desire for this group to go on further, but Caspian's right. These guys have been away for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And how many dangers have they already just barely gotten through? Some were sold as slaves and had to be rescued. Some could have died. One did when the sea serpent attacked. They could have been killed by the Duffelpuds while they were still invisible. They could have been turned to solid gold. All these things could have happened. And so, you know, maybe these guys have had enough. So if they have fulfilled what they have signed on for, we got to be careful about pressing them further. And what does Ramandu say about this? He actually kind of underscores the importance of the sailors agreeing to come. You remember him saying anything? He says, basically, it won't work if you bring unwilling people.
Exactly. Yeah.
They have to be willing, otherwise it won't work.
Right. Yes, that's so true.
It is not how great unenchantments are achieved.
Exactly right. Not through force or compulsion,
right?
But through willing sacrifice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, now, we've mentioned Lord Rupert, and it would almost be unfair, this poor tortured guy, who was just a shell of a man. But there's also a solution there. What is that?
If he remains there.
Yep.
Right. At the table.
If he will come to the table with his fellow lords,
yes.
He too will be granted an enchanted sleep,
yes.
Which will be restful,
mm-hmm.
And there will be no dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of anything else this guy would want more? So, they send word for him, here come the rest of the sailors, and now they need to talk out what's going to happen. So, early on, what seems to be happening with the crew?
They were anxious to get this over with and get back. But,
weren't happy about that. They were volunteers. They didn't really...
They weren't in on it. They were the adventure part of it.
Yeah.
So, and when we start getting, some people who are like, I just want to go home. We get some people who are starting to say, the weather in these parts means you really ought to do this. There's a lot of relatively sensible talk, but there are very divergent opinions. It comes down actually to Rhynelf. Who reminds everybody, look, we've not been pressed into service here. Every single one of us signed up because to be a part of this voyage, this quest, is an honor greater than becoming a knight. And we thought this was awesome. If we got to this point and knew there was just one more stop to make and we went home, wouldn't we regret that forever? And so, how does that go over?
Well, some of them agreed and cheered.
Pretty good. It goes over pretty good, but not perfect.
Right.
There's still kind of a... So, Caspian has one more trick up his sleeve. What does he do? This is an excellent use of his authority as king.
He tells them they haven't understood their purpose. We talk as if we had come to you with our hat in our hand begging for shipmates. It wasn't like that at all. We and the kings and Reef Chief at night and Lord Drinian have an errand to the world's edge. Our pleasure to choose from among such of you as are willing those whom we deem worthy of a high enterprise. We've not said that any can come for the asking.
So basically, how does he turn this back?
Makes them make the decision.
He changes their minds and their thinking.
Basically, he says, this is not about you deciding if you want to come or not.
Right.
This is about you proving to us that you're worthy to join us. We're going anyway on the greatest adventure that any man has ever known.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure that I'm going to take you. And all of a sudden, instead of these guys deciding, is it worth the risk or not? Well, suddenly, not only has their honor been called into question, but now they're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to be unworthy for that. I mean, what? We've gone this far, and you're gonna take him and not me?
Don't want to be left out.
And so, I hear echoes of something in this speech that Caspian gives, and it's brilliant. It's truly brilliant. And basically, in the end, all of them decide absolutely, we want to go. And they start sucking up and currying favor. And, hey, remember how I was so great? To, you know, so the Drenian would put their name on the list. What I hear out of this, I hear the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V.
Oh, wow.
So, before they go fight the French army, the overwhelming French army, he basically tells them, this band of brothers, that's where the phrase comes from, we're smaller than they are, and people can say that we're fools. But what we do today is going to be remembered. And we are going to fight like no one's ever seen. And even if we lose, we'll be remembered forever. It's going to be the people who weren't here that are going to feel like they've missed out, not us. They're going to be in their bed safe and sound and maybe live a long life, but they are going to be ashamed. But you and me, we are brothers in this blood forever. You know, Caspian says, you will carry the title of Don Treader and you will pass it along to your children and your children's children. You will have gold and riches. You will have lands when you come home, and you will have this honor that can never be taken from you.
So that's quite a lot to put before them.
And they all basically say, we're in. Yeah. Now there's the one poor doofus.
Okay. Bitten cream.
Bitten cream. He is the last holdout, and then what does he do? Mm-hmm. Right at the last second, he says, well, yeah, I want to go too, actually, because he didn't want to be left alone.
That's right.
But, you know, Caspian uses some of the king's justice, and what does he do? He says no.
That's right.
He says no.
I know. That was so
unusual. You don't get to be a part of this begrudgingly.
Yeah.
You know, if you had, if you had joined with everybody else, you would have been gladly welcomed. But because you held out to the end, this wasn't punishment like you should have made up your mind earlier, but it was because the only reason you're coming is because you didn't want to be alone. That's not a good enough reason to join us. When I made that speech, I meant it. And if you let Pit and Cream come, I think that undercuts Caspian's own words. He's not punished. He's not flogged or exiled or anything like this, but he says, look, you're going to have to wait here until we get back. So what happens to poor Pit and Cream?
Well, he sits there at the table with these poor sleeping people.
Right, just sort of lonely and miserable and regretful.
Yeah.
He gets to eat and he probably gets rained on.
Yeah, he's not the sort of person who's going to be able to talk to a star. So he just kind of twiddles his thumb for who knows how long. And what happens when the Don Treader eventually comes back?
He feels so proud of things. He deserted on the voyage home and the Lone Islanders. At the Lone Islanders.
Right. So they do eventually come back. He's with them. But it's so changed everyone to finish this quest that at the first chance he just leaves. He goes to a foreign country. And he starts telling stories about how he was a part of the crew. And eventually, he tells them for so long, he even starts to believe himself. And so that's kind of like his happy ending, is that even the lies about his cowardice, eventually he comes around to believe them.
But he could never bear mice.
That's right.
No.
So at the end of... at the end of Caspian's speech, this band of brothers speech that he gives, Reepicheep says, well, I'm going. I don't care if anybody else goes. But it is my heart's desire, it is my quest, and it is my commitment to reach the other east. And I will go until this boat will carry me no further. And then when it can carry me no further, I'm going to get in that little cork we found. And I'm going to keep rowing until that goes no further. And when that goes no further, I will swim. And when I can't swim anymore, I will drown facing the east. And Peepaseek will be Lord of the Talking Mice. And that was enough of an exclamation point on Caspian's speech where everyone's like, okay, yeah. We're in. You know, I'm not going to let a mouse have more honor than me about this. So here we go. Yeah. This is the commitment. We are going all the way. And right before they leave, Caspian has one more little bit of business. What is that?
With the Ramandu's
daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Hope to speak with you again when I've broken the enchantment.
That's right. So right before we go, I'd like to see you again if you don't mind. And she smiles. So maybe on the way back, if Caspian makes it, there will be more to their story as well. So, we are at the beginning of the end, not only in their voyage, but in our book. We only have two more chapters to go, 15 and 16. That will be our last class. We will do it next week, and we will be done voyaging with the Dawn Treader and traveling from Aslan's Table to the utter east and end of the world.
Which one comes after Dawn Treader?
After Dawn Treader is the Silver Chair.
Oh, it is in order then?
Yes.